No? Okay. Okay, so yesterday we introduced the Drude model of conductivity, and we derived the expression for the DC conductivity in terms of the density of electrons, the relaxation time, and the mass of the electrons. And the picture here, Michael interrupted by saying, what is tau? And so we had a discussion of that. But I was just going to say to you that from this expression, you can see that the units of conductivity are inverse seconds. And I was going to leave it to you to work that out. So the picture we have here is that, so let's go to, to time-dependent fields. The picture we have here is that the momentum of the electron is increased by the electric field, and it decays due to whatever it is that causes a diffusive motion, but that scattering of the electron, it decays with a characteristic time tau. So that's what I said, that the tau is the relaxation time for the momentum. And if your field, rather than being static, is, what did I call this, E naught? No, E of omega. Say it's something like this. Then P of omega is just minus E of omega over, what is it, minus I omega plus 1 over tau. That's the solution to that equation. And the electron current density in response at the frequency omega in response to the field with frequency omega is just minus which is, yeah. And then this, yeah.
Why is E a function of omega?
This is just the, okay, so two reasons. First of all, you can do that. You can make an electric field which oscillates linearly in time. Alternatively, because we're looking at the linear response, you can always decompose an arbitrary time-dependent field into its Fourier components and then look at, you know, frequency by frequency response. So this thing here is then the frequency dependent conductivity in the Drude model, sigma of omega, which is equal to sigma of 0 over 1 minus I omega tau, where sigma of 0 is what we said. That's where we started, n e squared tau over m. So the real part of this is just sigma of 0 over 1 plus omega squared tau squared. And the imaginary part is sigma omega tau . So this starts off linearly for small omega. And this thing looks like this. Looks like that. Where this is 1 over tau. Okay, so this is the frequency-dependent conductivity in this simple model that just has a single relaxation time. And for copper at, this is, what's this, 0 degrees C? Tau is about something times 10 to the minus 14th, some short time, 1 over tau. Then if you pull out your calculator, is 0.7 times 10 to the 13th, seconds to the minus 1. 1 eV, I'm sure that Nima told you this back in August. 1 electron volt is 2.4 times 10 to the 14th. Seconds to the minus 1. So if I've done this right, h bar over tau is approximately 0.15 eV. So that's this. This is omega. And so what's the point here? The point is that the conduction electron response of the system has this Drude or Lorentzian shape, and this width in frequency corresponds to energies on the order of a fraction of an electron volt. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the out-of-phase response of the current to the field. Okay, and there can be some lag or something like that, some phase shift. Yeah, it definitely has a meaning. You can measure it directly.
Out-of-phase by pi over 2 means it's dissipated.
No. The conductivity is dissipated. So this is like a dielectric type response. Right? This is like an absorption. So this thing here, this is... are we saying this wrong? I think the... this is the... So I guess I wanted to make a point here because, you know, metals are reflective, okay? And for people that means that they reflect light whose energies is typically a couple of electron volts, okay, like red light, say. Even out into the blues, these metals are reflective. And it all comes from this, which is this response, which is down at fairly low energies. So you might ask yourself the question that if the conductivity is all occurring down here at a fraction of an electron volt, why is the metal reflective up at electron volts? And all the way through the visible out towards the ultraviolet, okay? And so first of all, let me just look a little bit more closely at this. There's one other parameter that I want to define. if you just write down sigma naught tau, that's n e squared over m tau squared, then this thing here is a frequency squared, because remember, yeah, sigma is a frequency. So this is omega. This is defines the plasma frequency, omega p squared tau squared. The plasma frequency goes like n. For a good metal, omega p tau is large, and that basically means lots of conduction electrons and long scattering time, not so much scattering. Okay. So the dielectric function So there's lots of different ways of expressing the optical constants of a solid. You can express them in terms of the index of refraction, which is another complex quantity. You can express them in terms of the dielectric constant or function, which is a complex quantity. Or you can express them in terms of the conductivity, which, as we just said, is a complex quantity. And there are all these complicated relationships between them. The dielectric function in terms of the conductivity is epsilon of omega. Now, I started writing 1 here, but I realized that, well, let's come back to that. 4 pi I sigma over omega. Yeah, that's right. That's there. And this is the effect. What I've missed here, okay, so let me. So if this formula were right for a metal, which I, and I'll change it slightly in a second, it would say that if the conductivity were 0, if it weren't a conductor at all, then the dielectric constant would be 1, okay, which is the dielectric constant of the vacuum. Okay. Now, that's actually not really true, because like if you change the metal a little bit to make it into an insulator, it would still have a dielectric constant, which was not 1, not the dielectric constant of a vacuum. But it would have the dielectric constant that was a property of that insulator. And all materials have dielectric constants that are not 1 because they're not the vacuum, basically. Okay, so this should be some dielectric constant, epsilon naught, which is like the effect of everything else except the conduction electrons and their neutralizing positive charge. Okay, yeah, Felix. I don't think so, because the question is how do you take out the conduction electrons? Like, say you had a metal, and you turn it into an insulator because it was almost still bound, you stick in a few extra electrons in the neutralizing background, so it became an insulator. Okay? That's still, or say you changed it the other way, by taking out all the conduction electrons and enough nuclei to make it a neutral insulator. Okay? It's not free space.
It's just okay. Epsilon naught.
Epsilon naught. Oh, no, this is not. This is epsilon without the conduct. Yeah, okay. So what do you want to call it? Poor EC would be another way of. But the point is what it means. The dielectric constant that if you remove the effect of the conduction electrons, what's left? There's all these ion cores and polarizable thingies that give you a non-zero dielectric.
I think the left-hand side has an index of C, and the middle one doesn't have any index. That's just epsilon.
Sorry, which one?
The left one. The
left-hand side is the dielectric
of
the whole.
C. Yeah.
No, this is of the whole thing. This is conduction electrons plus.
C stands for complex.
No.
And the middle C.
I just want to name for the rest of the contribution of the dielectric function.
That's your background.
background, B, let's call it B. How's that? This is the total thing, okay? And this is the effect of conducted electron. This is the effect of everything else.
If sigma is zero, isn't that thing real?
This would probably be real, yeah.
Okay, so you can just drop the index. I'm just talking about the notation, you know. I think usually they don't use any index for the middle one. It's just epsilon.
It depends where you are. There's many communities in this. Okay, but the bottom line is that if you look at the real part of epsilon, so this is whatever we call this epsilon. this is epsilon of sigma equals zero. How's that? And then what you get here from taking the real part of I times sigma is minus omega p squared tau squared I sigma over omega. Yes, I sigma over omega. Oh, did I give, is that wrong? This is wrong. Oh, no, it's got sigma naught. Okay, sorry. Yeah, that's right. Over 1 plus omega squared tau squared. Okay, this is right. I wrote sigma tau using this. And then I canceled an omega because of this.
Sorry,
yeah. Inverse seconds, yeah. You think I got a 2 pi wrong? Oh, h bar omega. It's E in electron volts over h bar in electron volt seconds or whatever. You know, it's a frequency of the, yeah. Okay, where are we going here? Okay, so the simple point is this. Is that if omega for frequencies that are small compared to the plasma frequency, this thing is negative. And that means that when you have a negative dielectric constant, the thing is reflective. For omega greater than or approximately, it depends on how quickly this is going through zero, omega p is positive, and this is transparent. Okay? So the point is that it's the plasma frequency that determines, and this too, this residual dielectric constant. So where this thing passes through zero, it's negative at low frequencies and it's positive at high frequencies. And so there's some frequency at which the material goes from totally reflective, electromagnetic waves don't propagate, into transparent. And for metals, for good metals, that's in the ultraviolet, near ultraviolet. Okay? And it's really determined not just by the scattering, but by how many electrons, conduction electrons, there are. In other words, it's determined by the density of electrons and the scattering time. Okay, so the next thing that I wanted to talk about is, actually Michael was asking this last time, what causes okay, so what is the mechanism for the scattering in metals? And the answer is there's a variety of things that can lead to this tau. One is phonons, which we aren't, which we're hardly talking about in this course, although they will also play a role in superconductivity. So one of the things, so phonons are lattice vibrations. I hope everybody knows that. And they're quantized waves in the that propagate in a crystal. They have a relationship between their frequency and their moment and their wave vector, just like electronic excitations do. They obey Bose statistics. They're not like Fermi. They're not like electrons in that respect, which means their number, I guess, isn't conserved. And so, you can have your electron moving through the crystal, and wham, some phonon comes in and scatters it. And so what determines how frequently this happens? Well, how many phonons there are, okay? And like T. And actually, it even works the other way. You know, you can have your electron going along and wham, it emits a phonon, goes along. And that actually, I guess, because these are bosons, has a 1 plus n because of the state that you're populating. You're creating a phonon. And at high temperatures, 1 plus n is like n. It goes like T. So any way you cut it, these things go like T. So 1 over tau no, not at high temperatures. So, yeah, because the spectrum, okay, so what Michael's thinking of is the spectrum of phonons extends from zero for your longest wavelength phonon all the way up to some high limit, which is called the roughly called the Debye frequency or something like that. It's the top of the one phonon spectrum. And when I say high T, I mean that T is greater than the largest phonon frequency. So then as you go down in temperature, the density of, you start to have less phonons available to do this. Okay, there's fewer around. And so things start to fall off more quickly. And actually, what Michael said, T cubed, is how quickly the phonons go away. But actually, interestingly enough, the conductivity goes away even quicker than that. In fact, for low T, goes like T to the fifth. Okay? And then you might say, oh, why is that? Why doesn't it just depend on the number of phonons? Okay? And the reason why it doesn't depend on the number of phonons is because this is the transport lifetime and not the electron lifetime. Okay? What does that mean? What it means is that what matters to get this relaxation is that you have to change the momentum of the electron. Okay? And if you absorb or emit a phonon which doesn't change the momentum very much, then you don't change, then it doesn't, it's not effective in causing the momentum of the electron to decay. So, for instance, if you go down to very low temperatures, down at the bottom of the phonon spectrum, all of your phonons have very low energy, which translates into very long wavelength. In fact, their energy and wavelength are proportional to each other, with the proportionality constant being the speed of sound. And those low-energy phonons are very inefficient at scattering, at changing the momentum of electrons. So therefore, at low temperatures, you actually get this T to the fifth. So if you were to plot the resistivity, or say the resistance of a piece of copper wire, a long piece of copper wire, to make it easy to measure, versus T, so what's happening here is that at high temperatures it's linear, and this actually is the kind of temperatures that you're used to if you do this experiment at room temperature. You can make a copper resistance thermometer. It's a great thermometer, okay? But then as you come down in temperature, this thing starts to go down, and in fact, it actually gets very small because T to the fifth is a high power of T, okay? So it will start off very flat. Okay, so that, however, is a property of a copper wire in which the only mechanism for scattering electrons is the phonons. So what that would mean is that it was otherwise perfect. In fact, it couldn't even have any surfaces because when the mean free path of the electrons gets too long, they scatter off the surfaces of the wire and things like that. And that actually happens. Yep.
So at very low temperature, their T-cubed phonons are each
phonon changes the momentum by one T, and the cross section is proportional.
The momentum transfer is proportional, something like that.
And also you need one more factor, the cross section is proportional.
This happens, you know, you have this deformation potential type picture of the phonon creates a, if you like, when you get the long wavelength phonons, what are they doing? They're really like just moving everything back and forth with some very long wavelength. That doesn't scatter electrons, okay? So, I mean, you can work through this, that would be the appropriate picture for long wavelength acoustic phonons, which is all that you have at low temperature. Okay, so anyway, it works out to T to the fifth.
Oddly, I think it's exactly the kind of cross-section suppression that I discussed for pion-pion scattering at low energies.
But not so oddly, right? I mean, it's all the same diagram. It's all the same bosons. It's not so odd. However, let's go on, because this saga, this is not the end of the story here, because actually, even before you get to scattering off the surface of the sample, which you can have when you have very long mean-free paths and very pure materials, typically you actually have a lot of defects in your crystals. Okay, in point impurities, point scattering impurities, other crystallographic defects like dislocations and more interesting things. All of those things will scatter electrons, and that was 2, so let's go to 2 here. I would call it impurity scattering. So this is elastic. Which is all it takes for electrons. It just like scatters you around the Fermi surface. So these impurities, this is supposed to be an impurity, are basically momentum sinks. Okay, the electron can bounce off, go off in a different direction, and that's a temperature-independent process. Okay, so what really happens here is that this thing comes down, and then all of a sudden, wham. It becomes independent of T. This is this is actually called the residual resistance. Let me just write that. And if you ever hear anyone using the term resistance ratio, it's just the ratio of the resistance at room temperature to the low temperature limit. So that's a measure of the quality of your sample, because the higher the resistance ratio, the smaller this thing is. Okay, so I mean, obviously this green line could have cut in here, or it could have cut in here, depending on how perfect your sample is. So that's an extrinsic, so-called extrinsic effect. The third mechanism is electron-electron interactions. No, not the ion cores, because remember, the electron is in a crystal momentum state, which is the solution to the problem of the ion moving in the background of the ion cores in a perfectly periodic crystal. And we use the symmetry, the translational symmetry, the crystal symmetry to derive all those plane wave states, and they're fine. They'll just go on forever. Okay, the problem is when your crystal isn't perfect, it doesn't have that discrete translational symmetry because you stuck in the wrong kind of atom someplace, for instance. Or you're missing an atom where there should be one. Okay, now all of a sudden, you don't just have the periodic potential of the crystal, which the Bloch wave functions are perfectly happy with, and they just sail along. You've got these inhomogeneous things, which breaks the discrete crystal translation symmetry. And so the crystal wave vectors are no longer good quantum numbers. Okay, so the ion cores, as long as you have a perfect crystal, they're just fine. They don't do anything. Now, their motion of the ion cores is what these phonons are. So that will scatter you. But the impurity scattering is due to defects. But just remember, in a periodic crystal, crystal momentum is a conserved quantity. Yeah?
So, does this say if there were no defects?
Then you follow the white line down to zero.
So that would be a superconductor?
No. As you'll learn when we go into superconductors, superconductors are much better than that. Okay? The fact that the resistance goes to zero is just like a superficial indication of superconductivity. Okay, it has many better properties than that. Okay, it would be a zero resistance metal, or perfect metal. Okay, so what about this? Is anybody shaking their heads here? Because electron-electron interactions, electron comes in, transfers some momentum. Okay. Is that going to contribute to tau, or to 1 over tau?
No.
Because?
Conserves momentum.
Right, and which means that it also conserves, it also conserves the current. Right. Yeah, I mean, we were saying momentum and current are the same thing. Yeah. So the point is that if you do this, just electron-electron interactions with that kind of diagram, Okay. Remember when we studied Landau Fermi liquid theory, we said that electron-electron interactions, or in fact the residual quasi-particle-quasi-particle interactions, actually give a lifetime to the quasi-particles that increases like the square of the distance from the Fermi energy. Okay? However, that's a lifetime which does not contribute to the current relaxation. That just means they're a little fuzzy in energy, but they still go along and carry their current. If they decay, they pass it on to some more complicated excitations which just carry the same current. Yeah, go.
You might be able to say this, but what about unclapped phrases?
Yes, exactly, exactly, okay? However, there is one qualification to this, which is if these guys can, for instance, the momentum transfer could be Q plus a reciprocal lattice vector. Okay, so for instance, the electrons can scatter off of each other and then give up a reciprocal lattice vector. And that starts to become complicated because it depends on the shape of the Fermi surface and where your initial and final states are with respect to the zone boundary. The zone boundary is half a reciprocal lattice vector minus or plus it. It's a complicated thing, but without going through such a calculation, so this is, there can be a contribution to the momentum relaxation due to umklapp. And if there is, the rest of the calculation goes through just like the lifetime calculation, where these things' initial and final states have to be close to the Fermi energy. And so this goes like T squared. Okay? So that's, if you have scattering due to electron-electron interactions, then it will give you a T squared. Okay. Now, yeah, so if you look in this classic book, which I mentioned, this big fat book by Simon called Electrons and Phonons in Metals, he works through this calculation. And then he makes the comment that no one has ever observed the T squared resistivity due to electron-electron interaction. I think that book was written in the 50s. Okay. So that is no longer the case. People observe this, and it's real. Electron-electron, there are lots of systems where electron-electron interactions are really important. Okay. So I think, let's stop there. And then go on to a new subject. Okay, so I'd like to turn to superconductivity. And just give you a little bit of the early history and some phenomenological descriptions. Now, I'm sorry I didn't post my notes earlier, but actually if you go on the wiki, they're up there. Are they up there now? Yeah, they're up there now. If you want to look at some of the, there's a couple of pictures here. But as I'm sure you all know, superconductivity was discovered by Kamerling Onnes. In 1911. And basically what he observed is the disappearance of the resistance in solid mercury, which was a metal which was easy to make pure, right around 4.2 Kelvin, which is the boiling point of helium, which is often a warning sign when you measure something there. But in any case, so basically what he saw was the resistance versus temperature. This is 4.2, roughly. It was coming down nice and linearly, and then all of a sudden, it did that. Okay? And he couldn't measure anything. I mean, values that he measured down here to the best accuracy that he could get were consistent with zero. Now, it's important to understand, well, it's not important. It's interesting and useful to, mainly interesting to understand a couple of things. How was it that he discovered superconductivity? His real business was making refrigerators. In fact, he would make refrigerators which would liquefy gases, and he worked his way through a sequence of gases. The ones that liquefy at the lowest temperatures are the rare gases, helium, neon, xenon, krypton, and so forth, plus H2 molecular hydrogen, which is a little bit like helium-2, I guess. So he gradually pushed his technology to the point where he could liquefy helium, at which liquefies at around this temperature. And actually, with helium, you can go much lower then, because you pump on it, and you can go down close to 1 degree above absolute zero. So that gives you quite a wide range. It's a factor of 4 in temperature that you can go over at liquid helium temperatures. And so he discovered, he liquefied helium. In 1908, and then 3 years later, he discovered superconductivity. So the fact that he could work with liquid helium, he could work at these very low temperatures, meant that he could study the properties of pure metals at low temperatures. And so he was trying to understand, because remember, this is like before quantum mechanics. Although probably, I guess, not before Drude. But he was trying to understand the behavior of very pure metals, the resistance of very pure metals at the lowest possible temperatures. And it's interesting, let me just read one of the things that he said in his Nobel lecture. And this was after describing the design of a very, very complicated refrigerator, which allowed him to do this. Lots of pictures. He said, with this cryostat, investigations into the extraordinarily great conductivity of some metals at low temperatures were possible, and I wish now to report on these. Even the very first experiments on the resistance of metals had brought very surprising results. With platinum wire, there was no re-rise in resistance after reaching a minimum, as would be expected if the electrons which provide the conduction were firmly frozen to the atoms at low temperatures, but on the contrary, became independent of temperature. The conclusion drawn from the results of an experiment carried out with Mr. Clay down to the freezing point of hydrogen was that for absolutely pure platinum, resistance would disappear at the boiling point of helium. At the lowest temperature, therefore, the conduction electrons are not bound, but the factors which hinder their motion disappear. Okay? So what was he thinking? This was the Nobel lecture. Sorry, I had that in an earlier version of this. Something like that. So the picture that they had was that if you cool down to low enough temperatures, eventually the conduction electrons would just stick to their atoms, and the thing would become an insulator. Okay, and so he was expecting, that the resistivity would be coming down, and then at some very low temperature it would just go shooting up. Okay, and what he found instead was that it came down and it went to a constant. But the purer he made his metals, the smaller the constant was. And so that he could imagine, because with some uncertainty, that there was some temperature at which the resistance would vanish. But he wasn't thinking of this. He was thinking of something going smoothly to zero. For instance, like if you had a perfect metal, the phonon resistance going to zero. It's actually interesting that there are systems which have been studied much more recently where the resistivity of the metal goes through a minimum and then comes up. And this is the so-called Kondo effect with the resistivity minimum that has to do with magnetic scattering scattering off magnetic impurities. But nevertheless, he wasn't expecting this. Okay. So that was a very dramatic discovery. Another property that was observed was perfect screening. Which is that if you turn on a magnetic field, supercurrents flow which exclude it. So, I mean, that's, I guess, self-explanatory, that if you have a perfect conductor and you turn on a magnetic field, you'll get induced currents. I think in the case of normal metals, you think of these as eddy currents. But basically, they're trying to keep out the field. They're flowing in response to the change in the field, and they try to keep it out. Okay, so this was observed, I think, probably by Camerlingonis. Okay. What was much more dramatic, which was discovered somewhat later, is the Meissner effect. Which was Meissner and Otzenfeld. This was in 1933. And this is like one step beyond the idea of perfect screening. What Meissner found is that if you cool a sample, this is a magnetic field. What do I want to say? The field is expelled. So that's actually one of the things that I meant when I said that these superconductors are even better than perfect conductors. Because if you can imagine, this is the classic thing, if you have a perfect conductor and you try to introduce a magnetic field, then its currents will flow spontaneously to screen the field out. You won't be able to get it in. But if you have a perfect conductor, how should I say it? Say that you can vary something else like the temperature, and at high temperature it's not a perfect conductor, at low temperatures it is. You would imagine that at high temperatures you could get a magnetic field into it, so it could be sitting in a magnetic field, and as you cool it down and its conductivity becomes higher and higher, actually the magnetic flux penetrating the sample would have a hard time moving, because the field inside the sample, if it were to change, that would create currents that would want to prevent that from happening. Okay, so just as so basically it would not expel the field. Okay. So the point is that this field expulsion property is not just perfect conductivity. What it's saying is that whatever the phase of the superconducting material is, it doesn't like having a field. Yeah.
Does it expel gradually as you cool down the
superconductor? Not really. So depends. I mean, you know, these are complicated time dependent effects,
it's and, like it, exists and it's gone.
It gets pushed out.
Yeah,
okay, so there's a lot, I should say that there's a lot that I'm sweeping under the rug here. So to get that to happen, you have to do it very carefully. And we'll talk later about the fact that there are different kinds of superconductors. There are ones where if the field can only penetrate by destroying the superconductivity of the whole sample. And that's the kind that I'm talking about here. Those are called type 1 superconductors. And there are other kinds of superconductors which are called type 2 superconductors, where the field can penetrate the sample, but it penetrates in these little filaments, which are called vortices. So where the core of the vortex is a normal metal and around it is superconducting. It's a complicated system. There's also things like flux trapping. If your sample isn't perfectly homogeneous, it might want to expel the flux, but because of some inhomogeneity, it might not be able to get out. Yeah, Shane.
Do you have a different plot for alternating?
So what you're saying is, okay, so yeah, so what you're saying is equivalent to saying, what's the conductivity spectrum of a superconductor? So I showed you the Drude conductivity, sigma versus omega, which is this peak. Okay, and so you would say, okay, how does that change when you have a superconductor? And the answer is it changes in a number of ways. You have a delta function response at omega equals zero. You have no conductivity response at finite frequencies up to a frequency that's related to what's called the superconducting gap. And then it starts to look like a normal metal. Okay, so there's a lot to the finite frequency response. That's just the real part and the imaginary part. Yeah. Okay. So what does this mean? A large enough field, which I'm going to call HC of T, will destroy superconductivity. So another way of saying that is that the free energy densities Okay, and then experimentally, might as well put this in, because you can measure this HC of T, and it looks roughly like this. And in this region, you have superconductor. And in this region, you have a normal metal. Okay, and I just want to point out, so I've introduced some notation here. I've introduced the critical field. I've introduced the critical temperature, which is just that temperature that Camerlingonis discovered for mercury, 4.2 Kelvin. And basically what I've said is that the superconducting state has a lower energy than if the system didn't go superconducting, you could somehow keep it normal. That would have a higher free energy. And the difference is this, which is the amount that you have to sort of increase the energy to get the field out. Okay? So the superconductor is just holding this field out. But at a certain point, it doesn't have enough free energy, excess negative free energy density, to accomplish that. And so that state gives up and passes it over to this normal metal state. Oh, and normal metal means not superconducting. And you can always imagine, and in fact, this is an experiment that tells you how to do it. You have something which is a superconductor, and you crank up the field, and you end up in the normal metal state, which is presumably rather like, which is the corresponding metallic state. Okay, so normal metal means not superconducting. Okay, so there's actually, those are the conclusions drawn from the observation of this Meissner effect. So basically what happens is you cool the metal down, and at TC there's a phase transition. The normal metal state is unstable. And instead, the system becomes superconducting because that does better. And this tells you something about Fermi liquid theory, okay? So when we did Fermi liquid theory, we were basically, the basis of that was that the ground state of a system of fermions is something that looks like a Fermi liquid, which is adiabatically connected to the non-interacting Fermi gas. But what's happening here is that the Fermi liquid doesn't make it down to T equals zero. Something else happens. So the Fermi liquid is unstable. And the question is, unstable against what? And what kind of phase is this? Okay. Should I go on for 5 minutes or? Yeah, I can do a little bit. Okay, so let me just sort of set up this calculation of the London equation. Maybe we can come to a quick, suitable stopping point. So the understanding of superconductivity had to wait 45 years or so from the discovery of Camerlingonis until the theoretical discoveries of Bardeen, Cooper, and Trieffer. But it wasn't because no one was working on trying to solve the problem. I mean, people were thinking very hard, and this is an incredibly dramatic effect. And London, I guess this is Fritz London, in his book on superfluids, basically made an argument that okay, this is clearly a quantum mechanical effect, the superconductivity. The superconducting ground state is the one that's more stable than the normal metal. And he basically argued that the superconducting ground state should be a zero momentum state. Wave function should So in the presence of a vector potential, the momentum of the state should be given by the mass times the average velocity of the superfluid plus the vector potential, where this is the charge of whatever the charged objects are. And that should be zero, he argued. The supercurrent density is just ENS where this is the density of these superconducting thingies with charge E. And so that should equal from here minus E squared NS A. So basically, this is a statement that there should be a supercurrent in the presence of the vector potential that depends on the density of the superconducting fluid, if you like. And that's pretty much it. So this is what he conjectured. Yeah. Speed of light. So this is a pretty funny equation. Yeah. I don't know. CGS? Yeah. Say that again? H bar equals 1, probably. Does H bar enter into this? Probably. I don't know if there's an H. I don't think there's any H bars in this equation. Yeah. So I thought you were going to say what gauge are you working in? Because usually the vector potential, you can only, you know, you can add or subtract anything to it, which is a pure gradient of a scalar function, which is, changes the gauge. And so on the left-hand side, we have something that you can measure by looking, say, at the magnetic field that it creates or whatever. You've got a super current. It transports charge. On the right-hand side, you've got something which is completely arbitrary in some ways. And so so this is not gauge invariant. But actually, he had a gauge in mind, which is that div A equals 0 and A goes to 0 in the bulk. Okay. So this equation makes sense in that gauge. Okay. But I think we better so actually, maybe this is a good place to stop, because this probably all seems totally mysterious. And so you can think of your questions, and I'll think of the answers. We can start again tomorrow morning and see what the implications are if, in fact, putting on a vector potential creates a supercurrent, what that means. Okay.